The Gospel of John, chapter 2, a very, very familiar story to you. It's the story of Jesus' miracle where he turns water into wine. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, "Now, draw out some and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. When the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." This, the first of the signs Jesus did in Cana in Galilee, and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The word of the Lord. If I have an outline for this sermon, which I so seldom do, it is found in that very last verse. It says, this is the first of Jesus' signs that he did in Cana in Galilee. That's the first point. The second one is he manifested his glory. And the third one is his disciples believed in him. This sign Jesus gave is one of those miracles that Jesus performed. John's gospel is different from the other 3 gospels. They all record the miracles and the signs and the wonders that Jesus did. But John records them in kind of a pattern to where we can see them. He records 7 very significant signs. And with most of them, he will attach an "I am" saying. For example, he healed a blind man and said, "I am the light of the world." He fed the 5,000 and said, "I am the bread of life." John constructs his gospel along these 7 signs, climaxing, of course, with the resurrection of Lazarus, where Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life." And as John structures this, it's interesting that he uses the word "signs." This is the first of the signs that Jesus did, because there are a couple of 3 words that indicate the miracles that Christ did. One just talks about the phenomenon of the miracle itself, the withered hand being made whole, the issue of blood being cleared up, and the phenomenon of the occurrence itself. Another one of the words emphasizes the power, the dynamic that's in the miracle, such as calming the raging storm. But the other word, the one that's used here, is the word that talks about the sign, the significance. Jesus' miracles were not just blind, sheer, mere, unadorned acts that demonstrated how he had divine power. They certainly did that. But they were not disconnected to profound significance. And that's what we see here in this miracle. It's called in this text the first miracle of Christ. And it probably was, chronologically, if you look at the layout of the Gospels, the first miracle that Jesus performed, done very early in his ministry. And it was also perhaps one of the most significant. The word "first" here can mean either first in time or first in importance. And Jesus' miracle here, I submit to you, was of profound importance. Now, you all know the story. You've known it since Sunday school. The story is simply this, that Jesus has already called at least 6 of his disciples. He may have called all of them by this time, but we know he's called James and John, and Andrew and Peter, and Philip and Nathaniel, and they're with him. His mother has already been at the wedding. These weddings in this ancient culture would go probably about a week long. The people would kind of gather as the week went along, and it would reach kind of a climax when they would have a procession with lamps and torches. You remember Jesus' parable. And they would go with their torches to the bride's house and bring the bridegroom. And then they would to the bridegroom's house, and the bridegroom then would come forth. Behold, the bridegroom cometh. And then there would be a ceremony. One of the things that was significant about these ceremony, this particular event was the eating and the drinking. It was the best food. In fact, the word that's used here is the chief table master. He was a caterer or a host or someone that was in charge of making sure that everybody had enough to eat, enjoyed every meal that they had, and also had the very finest beverages to accompany the menu. In this particular occasion, it says Jesus' mother was already there, and Jesus came with his disciples because he had been invited as well. And you know the story well. What happened is they ran out of wine, which is a profound embarrassment in that culture. And Jesus' mother came to him and said, "They have no wine." And Jesus responds to her and tells her that he has an hour that is on his mind, an hour that he is thinking of. There's an hour to come. And he says, that hour has not yet come. But just because that hour has not yet come in time and in fulfillment does not mean that that hour is not upon us. And especially that that hour is not upon the mind of Christ himself. Jesus came for a purpose. He had a mission. He began his ministry. He knew he was headed for an hour of profound suffering, an hour of profound glory that he would receive. But here early in his ministry, he simply responds to the need. And by the way, Jesus will respond to just about any need you have if you ask him. He responds to the need. And the need is, of course, for wine. And he asks the servants to fill these stone water pots, which they fill, and they fill them to the brim with water. And then Jesus tells them to draw the water out and take it to the chief table master. And he sees the quality of this, takes it to the bridegroom and says, "We've saved the good wine till now." And this, of course, was a profound miracle. Now, if you'll notice the quantity there, it's pretty significant. 20 or 30 gallons, 6 water pots. That's about 120 to 180 gallons of wine. That's a lot of wine for a small wedding party in ancient Palestine with maybe just a few score people present. A lot of wine. That had to mean something. That had to have a significance. And if you knew what Jesus knew and what his disciples perhaps knew and were learning more about it, you knew the ancient Hebrew scriptures, the promises of God going all the way back to the book of Genesis, where when Isaac blessed Jacob, he gave many facets to that blessing. But one of the things he said is, "May God give you plenty of grain and wine." Then later on, when God was leading his people into the promised land, he told them through the mouth of Moses, said, "You will drink the wine of the vineyards that you did not plant." And then when the Lord recounts his blessing upon Israel through the lips of Hosea, he says, "It was I who gave Israel the wine. They shall flourish like the grain. They shall blossom like the vine," says Hosea. Joel, "In that day..." And any time in the Old Testament when it says "at that time" or "in that day," you need to pay attention, because that's talking about the great eschatological day of the Lord. That is that last day, that day of fulfillment, that day when God, after centuries of forbearance and waiting, will burst forth with the manifestation of his glory and the fulfillment of all of his promises. And now that day has come. But Joel talks about it. He says, "In that day, the mountains shall drip with sweet wine." Amos has the same theme. He says, "The mountains shall drip sweet wine, and all the hills shall flow with it." And you see what's being built up? There's an expectation of the blessing of God upon his people. The overflowing and the abundance of God's provision for his people. And it's being signified in this particular miracle. First miracle Jesus does. Very few people know him. He's starting to open the curtains and unveil just a little bit of the glory of God. Not the whole manifest glory. In fact, his glory will fully be manifested in that hour, in that day that he points to. His hour has not yet come when he is manifested by the Lord himself, the Father himself, with all of his glory. But here we have just a little crack in the curtain and the beaming forth of the brightness of the glory of God seen in this particular picture. And that is the picture of abundance, overflowing wine. Wine in the Old Testament symbolized the richness and the blessing of God. And it always pointed to some day in the future when there would be some kind of feast, some kind of great last day, end time, magnificent, wonderful feast. Jesus speaks about it in each of the Gospels several times. He talks about a feast. The prophet Isaiah spoke of it in 25 chapter. He said, "On this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast. A feast of rich food. A feast of well-aged wine. Of rich food of marrow. Of aged wine, well refined." This is not the wine that comes from a vat in California from 2 or 3 years ago. This is the wine of the ancient cultures of winemaking, where families for generations would nurture the vineyards and prepare and age the wine. And they were not concerned how long it took, and they were not concerned at what cost. They were not into mass marketing. They were concerned with the richness and the best. And it was imperative that they have what the scriptures call the well-aged wine and the wine well-refined. The good wine, the wine that brings nurture to the body, the wine that brings joy to the spirit, the real thing. The good wine. No wonder the steward said, and the bridegroom said, "You've saved the good wine till now." Oh yes, that's what's happened. God has saved the good wine until that moment, that fullness of time when he's going to bring forth his Son into the human race to save the peoples and save the nations. He saved that good wine till now. But when Jesus came on this very first miracle, he set forth the manifestation of his glory. Jesus himself is that good wine. And it symbolized so much that associated with Christ. The most obvious reference we have is that Christ's blood is symbolized by the wine. The Lord himself said, the night in which he was betrayed, when he lifted the cup, he said, "This is the cup of the new covenant in my blood," when he had the wine. The overflowing wine is the overflowing abundance of the blood of Christ. The overflowing abundance of the provision of the blood of Christ. The intrinsic power and purging qualities and qualities that bring to the soul joy and exuberance, and that bring to the body nutrition, well refined. Jesus is that new wine. It's interesting, there are a number of allusions in this passage that we don't have time for today, but one of the things is they were in water pots. The water was in these water pots, but they were stone water pots. Typically, water pots are clay. They were not. They were stone. They were water pots that had been hewn out of stone. It's interesting that the water that was in these pots was preserved for a particular purpose, and that purpose was the purpose of cleansing or purging. Moses gave the people, and you read about it in the book of Leviticus, several cleansing rituals that involved water, moving water, clean water, flowing water, water that was sprinkled and splashed and poured upon the peoples for various ritual reasons. But the Jews had added to that a number of ceremonies, washing ceremonies. So what you had here in these stone water pots is the water that symbolized the cleansing. Moses had brought water out of a stone. But now we come to a more significant event. Now out of a stone, a living stone, a cornerstone a stone that has been hewn out of the mountain and is rolled down to bring judgment upon the nations. Christ, contained in it is the blood, the atoning blood. That was my second point. He manifested His glory. Here's the last one. And His disciples believed in Him. His disciples believed in Him. I don't know how much of the great significance the disciples were able to see right then. I do know the Lord had a good teaching practice of sort of exposing them to something, letting them ask questions and wonder what it was all about, and then He would answer their questions or even ask them some questions. And as He did that, He would, as a brilliant teacher, He would build upon their understanding of a particular event or a particular occasion. And in this particular side, I believe that Jesus built upon it throughout His entire ministry. It's interesting that John, in recording his gospel, does not record the transfiguration of Jesus. That is the time when Jesus was up on the mountain with the disciples and He manifested His glory and He radiated and they were able to see His divine presence within His human person in a very real, dynamic way and witnessed it with their own eyes. We beheld His glory full of grace and truth, John says in his gospel. This is one of those times when they were able to see Jesus and His fullness. But it was not the radiation and the fullness of the resurrected Christ at this point. But the first order of business was for them to understand the blood. Wine in the Old Testament is also very, very significant in used in terms of judgment. Briefly, the story is that God planted a vineyard, a beautiful vineyard, and it was Israel, and the vineyard grew sour grapes. And the grapes were so sour and so useless that God could not use them. And God promises in His judgment to come Himself and tread out the wine press of the ruined, sour, spoiled grapes and make a bitter concoction that would be put in a vial, in a cup. And it's called the cup of God's wrath. These are the grapes of wrath. And it will be in that hour that has not yet come yet at Cana, but will soon come at Calvary and in Gethsemane, where Jesus will take that bitter cup and drink it to the dregs on behalf of His people, thus bearing their sins, thus applying in a real but spiritual way, the cleansing and the real purification, not just the purification of water, but the purification of His atoning blood. And in that, He's making a change. Jesus changed water into wine and demonstrated the significance of it. If nothing else in this particular story, we ought to at least understand the notion of change. Jesus changed water into wine. That's it. That's what He's in the changing business. Jesus is in the transforming business. He can change darkness into light. He can change sorrow into joy. He can change fear into love. He can change death into life. That's what Christ does. I was trying to explain to a man a year or so ago and talking with him about his spiritual life, about what Christ can do for him, how Christ will hear his prayer, He will forgive his sins and will receive him unto himself, and how Christ will be to him all that he needs. And this particular man had a lot of needs in his life. I was kind of overwhelmed at the emotional and the financial and the relationship needs and gaps and shortcomings there were in his life. This man was suffering immensely. And I was delighted to bring to him the good news that Jesus is what he needs and completely. And what he will do for him in terms of changing him and transforming him. And I remember the man looking at me rather cynically and sarcastically saying, "You're just talking about a miracle." I said, "Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a miracle, a change from the inside out that God effects from the top down. Has that miracle, that change occurred in your life? Have you come to that fountain? The book of Zechariah says in chapter 13, the Lord says, in that day, I will open a fountain in Jerusalem for the cleansing of their sins. And that's what Jesus did when in a few short years he came to his hour. And in that he took your sins and the punishment due you for your sins upon himself. He drank that. That's that cup that he prayed should pass from him. But nevertheless, God's will be done. And he drank that cup for you in order that you might imbibe the fruit of the true vine, Christ himself. Merely in symbol and sheerly with grape juice, we shall partake. But what's going on spiritually is a mystery that I am tongue-tied to speak about today. Something in the receiving of Christ by faith in your heart, feasting on him. Oh, by the way, we're going to take bread too. There was an abundance of wine at Cana. It wasn't too long down the road when Jesus had an abundance of bread. You remember the feeding of the 5,000? Yeah. The bread and the wine, very, very, very significant as a sign. No wonder the disciples believed in him.